Thanks again to Doug and Adam Burrows, I think, who initially extended his invitation, though he's not here this week, I understand. Not quite sure why I'm here. I'm sort of a member of an underrepresented majority, being a white male from the Midwest, as well as an observer at this group here. And I didn't find out how long the talk was supposed to be until this morning when Peter Bodenheimer said, oh, you're supposed to have 3 view graphs or something like that. I had over 50 when I started, and I've cut it in half. So this is going to be a bit painful, I think. You can stop me whenever, well, or I'll stop when I see you all sprawled over in your chairs. What I wanted to do, and basically I've cut out all the sort of nice, pleasant, fuzzy stuff, and I just kind of have the results now. And those of you who were at the Gordon Conference last July will recognize some of these results, but I've also added some new things as well just from the last couple of months. And in particular, I think Doug wanted to see some new results from the Spitzer Space Telescope. And if you indulge me to get to my last 2 view graphs, you'll see them. Okay, that's enough of that. You've all seen this way more times than you care to admit. And I'm not going to show the class 0 through 3 SEDs, so I'll spare you that. But I do show this, the resolved images of disks around young stars, in this case seen backlit in the Orion Nebula. Just wanted to remind you of 3 observational parameters for these disks. They're masses of order 0.1 to 0.001 solar masses. They're sizes of order 50 to 200 AU. The mass accretion rates, and again with this crowd, I always get into trouble using the word accretion, because here I mean of the gas material moving through the disk and onto the star. So the accretion rates onto the star have typical values of order 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. Observed parameters. This is a current paradigm that I'll be working from for the structure of what I'll call primordial disks around very young stars, and I'll define the difference between a primordial and a debris disk in a few minutes. Central Titari star surrounded by gas and dust in Keplerian rotation, accretion onto the star, there's probably a little hole in the inner disk, accretion through mediated by magnetic fields onto high latitudes, and probably associated with some outflow, and maybe even a little residual infall at the largest radii, the low angle momentum, the high angle momentum material falling in last. Disk structure. This isn't really modeling in the way that you all are used to hearing about it. I just mean, how do we infer physical properties from the data? I'll say this once and reiterate it a couple of times. Different wavelengths that we use to trace or use in observations trace different radii in the disks. Okay. So you can roughly guesstimate what the temperature distribution should be either from reprocessed radiation or through accretion processes what the heating distribution should be. You then integrate over different annuli and you get different black bodies contributing different amounts to the observed flux. 2 interesting limits: when you're very, very optically thin, you simply have a flux related to the mass opacity coefficient of the dust, which depends on its chemical nature and the particle sizes. And then you can get the mass of the disk, and that's what a lot of us do. When the disks are largely optically thick, then you get the standard result either through reprocessing or accretion luminosity generated in the viscous evolution of the disk, that the spectral energy distribution lambda f lambda goes as lambda to the minus 4/3. Just sort of 2 limits to keep in mind. Again, different radii trace different regions. So a lot of what you've heard about disk evolution probably comes from near-infrared studies, which largely trace the emission inside of 0.1 AU. Okay, and you hear about the disks only last 3 million years. That's a very coarse statement. It's not false, but it doesn't tell you what you really want to know. And those disks probably have inner holes. Mid-infrared spectrophotometry has suggested that there is a hot, optically thin region on the surface layers of the disk. That's useful information, and we can study emission lines from dust grains at those wavelengths. And the far infrared suggests, the very large far infrared excess that we see in these young disks suggests that the number one, that the disks are flared, and number two, that they have a sort of superheated dust layer. And I guess Eugene was talking about Kuiper belt disks, so he didn't talk about the Goldreich and Chang models. Okay, inner disks. I wanted to, a lot of us have studied this for several years, but I wanted to highlight this newer result from James Mazzarol and collaborators, where he's done spectrophotometry, taken spectra from 2 to 5 microns and looked at the structure of the very inner disks, and what they have found from spectroscopy, not just photometry, which we had done in the past, is that each of these near-infrared excess emissions can be modeled by a single temperature black body at the dust sublimation point. Now, as a theorist, you may have thought, well, that's the most obvious assumption you should have gone down when you started this several years ago, but we got sidetracked for technical reasons. But it does appear that these near-infrared excesses are characterized by large opacity at a temperature corresponding to the dust sublimation point at about 1400 Kelvin. What this suggests, as I'll show in a second, is that there may be a pretty significant region of gas only between the sublimation point and the truncation of the inner disk due to the magnetic field. This needs to be verified, but it's sort of an intriguing new result. These mid-infrared spectra I told you about, we take spectra at 10 microns. This has been done going back to Fred Wittebourn and Martin Cohen in the late 70s, early 80s. A lot of Titari stars show silicate emission line features. Again, optically thin component on the optically thick mid-plane of the disk. And sometimes we see evidence for dust grain evolution. And this is a beautiful sort of classic now result from the ISO Infrared Space Observatory launched by the European Space Agency, where we see a spectrum due to HD100546, a sort of a little bit older than your garden variety Herbig AEBE star, which is a higher mass analog to a Titari star. So this is probably a star that's, say, 3 to 5 million years old, probably a mass of 2 to 3 solar masses. And it shows evidence for crystalline silicate features very comparable to what you see in solar system comets, in this case, compared to Hale-Bopp. About 10% of the Herbig stars that we look at show this kind of behavior, and it could be evidence for significant dust processing because you never see evidence for this kind of crystalline silicate emission in the diffuse interstellar medium. So it didn't get accreted in that way from the standard ISM that we're familiar with. And then finally, these broadband SEDs can be modeled there are more and more complicated ways to do it. You add more parameters, you get better fits. That's certainly true. But some of these parameters are now being also fixed from direct imaging and interferometry in particular, confirming some of these more, what may seem sort of more convoluted, complicated models. In this case, I'm quoting a paper from Dulemon et al., and also Nuria Calvet has similar models for the TW Hydrae Association. Instead of an optically thick, geometrically thin disk that goes all the way into the surface of the star, as I said, we believe these disks have some vertical structure, which is important. In particular, these inner holes suggest that there will be a kind of a rim here where there's direct radiation, okay, that goes through that mid-plane. It'll puff up that inner hole, that inner edge of that disk, and that this region will have some significant solid angle then, which will go into that near-infrared excess. Again, the new work by Muzzarol and collaborators suggests that there may be a dust disk which will go into a certain point, and then there'll be a gas disk which will extend into this co-rotation point if the disks are indeed truncated through the interaction of the magnetic field in the disk. And again, there's some flaring that goes on out at the outer radii. And they do provide very nice models. What is meant to be pointed out here is that the spectral energy distributions between 20 and, say, 200 microns are sort of dominated by this surface layer and these large outer radii, different than the models you would have heard about 5 years ago. So those are some sort of basic properties. We think the dust disks have inner holes. They may have a gas inner region only. That's maybe interesting if you wanted to form chondrules through a kind of an X-wind model. And they do appear to have these flared extents and other complications associated with the structural picture I just flashed. Okay, evolution. Now let me flip over to show what we've learned observationally about how these disks evolve. Just a cartoon to show that I'm changing the topic a little bit from structure to evolution. Near-infrared excess fraction, how does it evolve with time? There's a famous paper, or now famous, often quoted paper. It's a very nice paper by Carl Haish and Charles and Elizabeth Latta. Very nice data, a compendium of near-infrared excess emission over time. We have a similar work. This is led by Lynn Hellenbrand, where we've taken a different observational approach, taking objects that we know the spectral types of the stars for. Therefore, we can more precisely estimate whether it does or doesn't have a disk excess. In the Haish et al. Case, they've simply taken multicolor photometry. They get a similar result. What you're seeing here is the fraction of accretion disks as a function of age. And each point represents hundreds of stars in a cluster of a different age. I say accretion disks here because from our experience in the Taurus molecular cloud, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the presence of a very near infrared excess at, say, 2 microns, again, tracing disk material in those very inner annuli, and the spectroscopic signatures of accretion onto the star. But this is a bit of an inference here. So you see dozens of clusters now plotted on this diagram, ages from 100,000 to 1 million to 10 million to 100 million to 1 billion years, and there seems to be a decrease of the fraction of stars with excess. Now, these fraction plots are very strange, and a priori you might not have thought this was the best way to represent the data. It's a very convenient way to represent it, but think about what this means. At 1 million years, already a quarter to 20% of the stars have lost their inner disks. Okay? This isn't a smooth diminution of near-infrared excess with time. It is the fraction of stars in a cluster. So what this represents is the dispersion of accretion disk lifetimes. Okay? A disk can last from 1 million up to, say, 10 million years. And different disks will hang onto their disks at different lengths of time. Now, I've also pointed in for our meteoritics colleagues different sort of time scales that I've been sort of educated to over time. There seems to be this offset between the CAI formation and the chondral formation of about 1 to 3 million years. And then at least the latest results I've heard confirmed again at the Gordon conference that it looks like terrestrial planet formation was, say, 80 or 90% done within 30 million years. And that's what I've meant to represent by those bars. Now, what I'm going to do is show you disk evolution as a function of wavelength. I'm going to show similar types of plots for different wavelengths, which will trace different radii. I'll try to make it as clear as I can. And at each point, I will indicate these three sort of meteoritic timescale constraints on those plots. One other point. The transition between optically thick and optically thin inner disks, although the lifetime of those inner disks can have a range of lifetimes, but the transition time appears to be very short. And we think we know that just from looking at the statistics of how objects move from this part of this color space to this part. So this is something with a strong inner disk going out here and a strong mid-infrared disk going up here. Okay. So the fact of the matter is that there just aren't objects in this region of the diagram. And statistical studies by several different groups have estimated that the number of transition objects versus the number of Titauri stars should be proportional to the transition the time scale required for that transition divided by the mean age of your sample, and you tend to get answers that the transition time is of order 100,000 years or less. So that the transition from thick to thin in those inner regions does appear to happen very fast. Okay, well, I've been talking about thick to thin, so what am I really talking about? What are these numbers that you can put your hands on for what this means? Well, if I asked how much gas would you need moving through a disk in order for it to be optically thick, and this is work that Nuria Calvet and I did for a paper in 97 about that inner disk structure, you'd have to have a really high accretion rate, sort of greater than 10 to the minus 7 solar masses per year, to be optically thick in the inner disk at, say, inside of 0.1 AU. That's a lot of accretion. That's not typically what we observe. How much dust would be required? Of course, the opacity of dust is orders of magnitude higher. So for the near-infrared, inside of, say, a tenth of an AU, you'd need just, you know, a few asteroids, big ones, but they would do it for you. Okay, you just grind them up into micron-sized particles. Of course, they have a lot of opacity. Mid-infrared, between 0.1 and 1 AU, it would take of order an Earth mass to be optically thick in dust in that region. So just grind up the Earth and stick it there. In the far infrared, you'd need a lot. You'd need several Jupiters to be optically thick in the mid-infrared. Just so that you know we can have these numbers handy. Now, it's often assumed that optically thin disks imply debris disks, but that's not necessarily true. And I'll touch back on this in a minute. What are primordial versus debris disks? I've started to introduce this nomenclature. Well, this is just my own definition, and it's unfortunately not observable necessarily. It's a physical definition, which a lot of scientists don't like. But I'll call a primordial disk something where the opacity is dominated by ISM grains that have been incorporated into the disk formation event. And I'll call a debris disk something that where the opacity is dominated by grains produced through secondary collisions. As Doug and I were talking this morning, if the planetesimal formation timescales that people such as yourselves come up with, which are very short by my standards, astronomically in timescale, those, you'll get very large objects very fast. If they start colliding into each other within 100,000 years, they will start producing this second generation dust. And where does the, as the grains grow up into larger objects, the opacity from primordial dust will go down. As the collisions start, the opacity from second generation grains will go up, and where do they cross? Which one dominates? It's not obvious how you would tell that observationally. One thing you might do is look for whether there's gas or not present in the system. And if the gas to dust ratio is less than 0.1, Pavel may have a different numbers for this. I always get confused about this. So you start off with a gas to dust ratio of 100, and if it drops down a factor of 1,000, then you might argue that the dynamics will not be dominated by the gas anymore, and then the radiation forces will take over, and you'll have blowout, and you'll have Poynting-Robertson drag. So those are very short timescales. Therefore, you would need to argue that the dust is being regenerated continuously. You might also look for evidence of dust processing through mineralogy. Do you see these silicate features, for example, crystalline silicates, coming into being at certain timescales as you look at stellar populations of different age? Well, these transition objects are rare, but sometimes they could be very interesting, and maybe those are some of the objects we should focus on. They're very hard to find because they're so rare. We've spent a lot of effort trying to identify these needles in the haystack. This is one fun example. It's a member of the SCOSEN Association, even though it's very far away from the core of that cluster, but kinematically we've identified it. It appears to have a disk. Now, this is an upper limit at 100 microns. These are IRAS data, and these are ground-based mid-infrared data. It's a binary where we were, for the first time, be able to resolve the disk emission around one of the components. This is an SED, which may look very similar to others you've seen, but it's actually a very narrow range of temperatures represented here. The dust temperature range is only between 200 and 800 Kelvin, and using standard assumptions for large grains, we estimate a size scale from 0.4 to 6 AU of the region where this dust is being generated. Not at larger radii, colder dust, and not interior to that. So something is going on to clear the inner region and perhaps also excite collisions from the outside, perhaps. And so this is a very interesting system we're trying to study, whether there could be protoplanets already in this system, which is a 20 million year old star in the upper SCOSEN OB Association. Well, there is no evidence for gas or accretion or anything in this particular system, but it's a good point. We haven't looked yet. It's very difficult to detect gas directly in a system like this, but assuming there's no gas, then you invoke the arguments that it must be a debris disk, but it's a good point. Another interesting system that we've focused in on recently with our techniques of nulling interferometry that Phil Hinz is pioneering at the University of Arizona is HD100546. This again is a slightly, that's the same one I talked about before that has the crystalline silicate emission. Here you're seeing direct images at 24 microns. It may not look much here, but when you subtract the PSF, there's some residual if the PSF is too small or too large and whether it's inclined versus the best fit. This also matches models of the spectral energy distribution, where there does appear to be a resolved disk in the mid-infrared that has an inner cleared region inside of 30 AU. There does not appear to be any dust that's emitting at 10 to 20 microns. So again, here's another system where we think there's a large inner hole in this region. This is a very young system, though. It's only of order 5 million years old. And I have a stack of preprints here, and I'm not leaving Santa Barbara till all of these are gone. So that may help motivate you. Mid-infrared excess evolving with time. Okay, I gave you a few quick shot examples of these so-called transition objects. Now let's look statistically at stellar ensembles at mid-infrared wavelengths and ask, how does the mid-infrared emission from, say, 0.3 to 1 AU evolve over time? And we've superposed the fit from Haish and Lada on here as well, so you can just compare them. Here's the Taurus region. There are a couple of other points that you could put up in this area. Very young things have lots of mid-infrared excess. And again, in the TW Hydra Association and the Beta Pictoris Moving Group, that's work by Alicia Weinberger and collaborators at the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism in Washington, D.C. And this is our new data point. Eric Mamajek is a student of mine just finishing up his thesis this spring. So we pulled a kind of a strong upper limit. This is a grouping of stars of order 20 stars that are thought to be 30 million years old by their aggregate ages from positions in the HR diagram. a post-T-Tauri stars, if you will, 30 million years old, and not a single one of them shows any evidence for 10 micron excess emission. Now, we can model how much could you just squeeze in there under the upper limits, and that's important because you don't just want to say, well, I didn't detect anything. The question is, did you detect the stellar photosphere, and can you place an upper limit on the amount of 10 micron excess here? And in this case, we've detected the stellar photosphere in every single one of the 20 stars, and none of them have an excess. So, again, I have to make a caveat with that it's less than 10 to the minus 6 solar masses of dust sprinkled in between those radii between 0.3 and 1 AU. And I can quantify that more precisely if you're interested. Now let's go to longer wavelengths, and here's where the data start getting worse and worse. These are data that a group led by Steve Beckwith obtained with the Infrared Space Observatory a few years ago. We didn't have the sensitivity with this survey to go down to detect the stellar photospheres, as I was just describing. But what we did do is have the sensitivity to detect all optically thick disks. So this plot only shows the evolution of optically thick versus optically thin disks, again, over the same timescales that I've been comparing to. So the frequency of optically thick outer disks, okay, tracing material between 1 and 10 AU at 60 microns, again, appears to follow the same kind of line. Now, what does this mean, and how does it compare to those other things? The way I interpret this plot is that the disks between 1 and 10 AU become optically thick on timescales comparable to the cessation of accretion in the inner disk. Okay, that's how I would characterize this result. It's not that there aren't any disks at those radii at older times. We certainly know of many examples where there are, but they must be optically thin according to these results. One of those kinds of objects that we've been following up for our Spitzer Legacy Science Program, which I'll describe in a minute, is this disk surrounding the star HD107146. It's a young-ish zero-age main sequence star, thought to be of order 100 million years old. It has a nice healthy excess at 60 microns, 100 microns, and at submillimeter wavelengths, where we think we have a tentative resolution of this disk at 450 microns. So this is a very interesting age range. It's starting to get out there towards older main sequence objects, yet it still has this very nice disk and this work that some of you may be familiar with by Scott Kenyon and Bromley suggests that these disks should, in fact, become colder as they get older or start tracing the larger radii. This is a paper in press from APJ Letters, led by Jonathan Williams. Okay, so what are the statistics of these outer disks? Now, I showed you that disks appear to become optically thin on timescales comparable to the cessation of the accretion phase. There are two other sort of conflicting studies on these same wavelengths, one by Hobbing's group in the Netherlands, also from ISO, where they make this kind of strange plot, and let me try to walk you through it. So what the group has done, it's an interesting way to plot the data, not a bad way, as I'm saying into the microphone. They've ranked the stars by age, okay, and now this is a cumulative distribution plot of those with excess as a function of age. So at the youngest ages, there is one star and it has an excess at 60 microns. The next star that's a little bit older has an excess, and so on and so on and so on. Then there are three stars that don't have an excess, and so you just keep moving along. The next one did have an excess, didn't have an excess, did have an excess, didn't, did, didn't, and so on. So it's a cumulative distribution function with a kink here at an age of about 400 million years. And they argue here that that corresponds to the era of maximum bombardment in our own solar system, so that something fundamentally different is going on at an age of about 400 million years. Most of the young stars will have an excess, most of the older ones won't. And that's Hobbing's result. Now, here's where we put it all together, and it's confusing. This is a paper by Spangler et al. It's the sort of U.S. North American counterpart to the European-led ISO group, led by Neil Sargent and Eric Becklin, and Celeste Spangler and Murray Silverstone. So they are now plotting the fractional infrared excess, so this is the far infrared luminosity divided by the bolometric stellar luminosity, as a function of age for many, many different samples that they surveyed, and they've plotted this F, this fractional infrared excess. What's a good typical star that you might know? The sun on this kind of plot is about 10 to the minus 10, just so you have a benchmark in your mind. And over here, they plotted lunar masses, the log of the lunar mass of that dust, if you make some standard infrared flux to mass conversions. Okay, so what are you seeing here? Well, I told you already At the youngest phases, actually, at ages less than, say, 10 million years, most of what you're seeing in this far infrared excess is tracing the geometry of the disk. So actually wouldn't put much stock in any of these first few points for the very young stars in the chameleon, young star forming region. You're just tracing geometry. Is the disk edge on? Is it face on? How flared is it? It doesn't really tell you about dust mass because they're all optically thick. But nonetheless, we believe from our work that there's a step here, that disks go from thick to thin on a time scale of order 10 million years. And furthermore, the Hobbing group is telling you that there is some evidence for evolution at 400 million years here. So now we've got a little stair step. They've plotted the data and fit a mass diminishing as t to the minus 2, and of course the data can't distinguish between either model, so we clearly need more work. All the data are sort of consistent with either hypothesis. You need more to answer the question. Now, an important question that you all would like to know the answer to is, where is the gas? When does the gas go away? Well, ISO also did some fundamental pioneering work in this area. There were some tentative detections made of molecular hydrogen gas in the disk. You know, we trace all the dust and we assume, for at least for young stars, that the gas to dust ratio is 100 and we proceed from there. You'd really like to measure the gas content. Furthermore, you'd like to measure it in the dominant molecular constituent, H2, but it's very hard to do that. It's, you know, homonuclear, doesn't have a permanent dipole moment, and so on. There are lines in the mid-infrared that you can get access to at 28.2 and 17 microns, which trace gas at around 100 Kelvin. All right, so that's an accessible experiment. There are also electronic transitions in the UV, and the FUSE satellite has started to do some very interesting work detecting the gas in absorption, colder gas along the line of sight. All right, so these are the detections here. I might ask those of you in the know to pick which ones are still believed or which ones are real. Those of you who have ever, you know, when you had to in graduate school, take a spectrum of something, you might notice that these baselines are really kind of strange looking, and that's partly because the data had to be so highly processed to get very good answers out of them. And it's sort of a testament to this team at how hard and well they worked at getting these results out. But some of them appear to have been spurious. For example, this object here, AB Auriga, when it was followed up on the ground at 17 microns, where there is a tiny window where you can sort of at very high spectral resolution do this kind of work from the ground, within a shell spectrometer where you get velocity resolution, you look for the line and you don't see anything. Now, there are a couple of explanations for that. Okay, what's shown here is a dotted line are two different kinematic models for gas. If you assume the gas was moving very slowly at 30 kilometers per second, given that flux inferred there, they should have easily detected the line. The other thing you could say is that all the gas is crunched up next to the star, and the Keplerian velocities are so large that the baseline gets smeared out. Okay, so it would have to be gas that was very close in, and that's what's shown here. Is something that's of order 100 kilometers per second, okay, spun up inside of 1 AU. The other thing you have to remember is that the beam size of the ISO observations were 28 arc seconds, giant swaths of space on the sky, compared to less than an arc second for these ground-based shell spectra. So maybe the H2 is coming from a very extended region, and maybe that's why it's not there from the ground. Well, that could be true and explain why make the observations concordant, but if that's true, then these data don't really speak to gas in a disk around a star. It's sort of this big, large-scale ISM type stuff. I'll also point out that there was a tentative detection of beta pic here, which was also observed with FUSE, again, absorption spectroscopy along the line of sight. They did make a detection of H2 with FUSE, which appears to be robust, but it's about a factor of 5 lower gas mass than is inferred from this observation. So there's some controversy here. Okay, what are the answers? Well, again, it appears that 50% of accretion disks inside of 0.1 AU appear to dissipate on timescales less than 3 million years. So that's point one. Point two, that's not every star in lockstep together. There's a large dispersion of evolutionary timescales for these disks. I didn't talk about these two bullets, stellar angular momentum regulation and disk accretion rates decreasing with time, although there's some observational evidence for that. And sort of my conclusion from these evolutionary plots I've been showing you is that there is a good argument for disk evolution, not dissipation completely, but evolution from thick to thin, different radii clearing out, on timescales comparable to the cessation of accretion. Okay, a couple of questions I'll just throw out that came up again at the Gordon conference. If you're into chondrules, do 10 Earth mass protoplanets cause big enough shocks in a disk? That's a favorite model from one segment of the community to form chondrules. Something that intrigued me initially when we got these results on disks going from thick to thin when accretion shut off is particle growth inhibited in a turbulent disk, and that once the turbulence goes away, you can grow up particles very rapidly and rapidly decrease the gas opacity or the dust opacity in the disks. Another question I have is does accretion terminate due to just some sort of standard alpha disk evolution? And if so, what shuts off the turbulence? What stops you from accreting onto the star? And a corollary to that is, once that happens, does that mean all the gas was gone? Is that partly why the disks stopped accreting? Or is there something else? You know, do gas disks survive beyond the termination of the accretion phase? And right now I say we don't know the answer to that. If they don't survive, then it's very easy to understand this transition timescale. It's simply the PR drag timescale. It matches perfectly. It's very, very short. Bam, the dust is gone. Well, this sort of leads into a brief advertisement for our Spitzer Legacy Science Program, and these are our three main goals: to study the formation of planetary embryos, and really to characterize this transition, if we can, observationally, between primordial and debris disks. One of our most exciting goals is to try to characterize this evolution in the gas component of the disk, and I'll describe how we're going to try to do that. And then as we look at the older systems, we're going to try to just take snapshots of them at different epochs and try to characterize the diversity of planetary architectures that we see in those data. How do we do that? Well, we're just going to make SEDs, basically. We're not going to resolve anything in this program, unfortunately. The stars are slightly too distant for us to be able to do that. This just shows a kind of a toy model for the evolution of our own solar system. And our goal with this program is to really focus on sun-like stars and answer the question whether our solar system and the evolution we've inferred for it is common or rare in the Milky Way galaxy. So we have 345 stars between 0.8 and 1.2 solar masses. We have roughly 50 to 60 stars in each logarithmically spaced age bin, so 3 to 10, 10 to 30, 30 to 100, and so on. So we try to have a medium-sized sample in each bin, and the distances are between 15 and 150 parsecs. Here's just some spectral, you know, energy versus wavelength. That's what a standard Titari disk looks like. Here's a toy model of our own solar system at 100 million years, and the ISO at a distance of 30 parsecs. ISO would have just been able to detect that object. Here's the CERTIF sensitivities here, very, very low. Here's what our solar system might have looked like at a billion years, and here's what it looks like today. The CERTIF sensitivity is great. However, you can't really distinguish lines like this, our own solar system, from the stellar photosphere, because the photometric precision you would need in order to do it would be incredible, and we just can't get there. But we do have great sensitivity. We're going to obtain spectra for every single one of our objects. So if there are indeed dusty disks and we can see emission line features from the minerals, we can try to estimate grain size and composition. This is just showing you the difference between amorphous and crystalline silicates at a resolving power of 100. It would be very easy to distinguish these two. Perhaps of more interest to this group is this plot by Dave Hollenbach and Uma Gorte. They've been working for over a year now on a very complex chemical model that we can use to interpret our results. We're going to take high resolution, or modest resolution, I should say, R of 600 spectra for about a subset of 50 of our stars between 3 million and 100 million years old to find out when the gas goes away. We can detect those lines at 28.2, 7, and 17 microns and hopefully do a better job than the ISO instrument was able to do because of newer detector technology. What you see in this plot is dust mass on this axis in solar masses, log of it, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 6 solar masses of dust, versus gas mass on this axis, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. This is a bit complicated here because if you've got too much dust in the system, at our resolving power, the line to continuum ratio would be too unfavorable. If you've got too much of a thermal emission component from dust, you'll never see the line against it. So that's bad. If you've got too much dust, that's bad. This is our detectability region, everything above these two lines. So too much dust is bad for a given gas mass. But too little dust is also bad because you actually need something to heat the gas. Okay? If the H2 is just sitting there with no dust, it basically doesn't even see the star. It can't heat up. So you need a little bit of dust to absorb that stellar radiation and go into heating the gas. So there's a sweet spot here. Nonetheless, we think this is still an interesting experiment. Our levels are down to a few times 10 to the minus 4 solar masses of gas at 100 Kelvin. And that's interesting for us because it ought to be where the gas would be at the ice line in the system. So if we don't see any gas, we're going to use the models that David and Uma have developed for us to constrain the amount of gas possible in the system, and therefore place an upper limit on the lifetime available for giant planet formation in these disks. So again, we're going to focus on 50 stars from 3 million to about 30 million years and find out when the gas goes away using David's models. All right, as advertised, a couple of quick snapshots of new results. These some of you may have seen if you're a space aficionado and have followed these things on the internet, but there were a set of early release observations announced on December 18th. This particular one by the Multiband Imaging Photometer for CERDF, that's the MIPS group, built by George Ricci at the University of Arizona. And what you see are observations of Fomalhaut, which is an A star, it's about 200 million years old. Here's an image at 24 microns and an image at 70 microns. Again, this is a little bit of the NASA space group, you know, overtaking other ground-based observations, because this, of course, had been resolved in the submillimeter already from the ground, and maybe even by ISO and IRAS had some preliminary, you know, extended point source kinds of scans across it. But here was a beautiful JCMT observation at 450 microns, confirmed by the MIPS observations at 70 microns, so much, much shorter wavelengths, tracing a dusty disk with a perceived inner gap here of, let's see if I can get it right, I believe that the radial extent goes from about 100 AU to about 150 AU in this donut region, and thought to be largely evacuated in the middle. What was interesting about these new observations is that even after accounting for the point source or the star itself, there does appear to be excess emission at 24 microns that is unresolved inside of about 10 AU. All right, so this may be actually a nice analog to our own solar system, where there's an outer Kuiper debris disk out here, but maybe also another inner debris planetesimal belt inside of 10 AU. So that's quite exciting, and it will need to be modeled in order to confirm that. It's also brighter on this side than that side. That's also seen in the submillimeter, and people have postulated that there's some dynamical resonance that is, you know, collecting particles on one side of the disk. We have only received data on 5 objects. It was our first validation data in the month of December. We pointed at 5 targets that sort of span the range of properties for our objects to see if our observing procedures were sound and appropriate for the current onboard performance of the instrument. We pointed at this star, which had actually had tentative ISO detections at 60 and 90 microns. We confirmed the detection at 70 microns, and there's also another point not shown on this graph where we've detected the source at 160 microns. We've also obtained shorter wavelength data and spectrophotometry, I'll point out, from 4 to 40 microns. What was amazing to me about this star, it's a G0 star. It's actually part of that Toccane Horologium Association I mentioned earlier that has a very pretty well-determined age of about 30 million years. Now, this sort of bothered me because we actually spent a lot of time collecting these spectra at these long wavelengths. It's just spot on the predicted stellar photosphere and confirmed at 24 microns with photometry. And then at wavelengths of about 35 microns, there's a light leak and we can't quite tell. All right. So there's no excess emission out to wavelengths of at least 35 microns. And then pow, it's got this whopping dust disk here at 60, 70, 90, and 160 microns, 4-band detection. It's modeled very nicely by a thin disk with a radial extent between 30 and 40 AU. And we have now put in a proposal to try to image the disk with the Hubble Space Telescope using its coronagraphic mode, because you can spread that dust out a little bit, but then the surface brightness of scattered light would diminish. And so if we can even get an upper limit with HST, using the NICMOS coronagraph, we could constrain better our model. The SED modeling, as you all know, is a bit degenerated in the grain properties, et cetera, we can get. But if we can resolve it at least one wavelength, that will break a lot of the degeneracies in our modeling and allow us to go forward. But our current best fit model is that it has a narrow range of annuli between, say, 30 and 40 AU. Another source here, HD150706. Again, no excess emission at wavelengths all the way out to here, and then bam, we detected it at 70 microns. This star is a little bit older. It's between 600 and a giga year old, so we sort of say 800 million years old plus or minus 200. And again, it's just the first 2 out of our first 5 objects that we've looked at. I guess I'd be remiss in commenting on this star that it is thought it was reported in a conference proceeding and on the internet to have an extrasolar planet associated with it. However, it's a young-ish main sequence star, and so the radial velocity curves are a bit difficult to confirm. And so this one is a little bit up in the air still, whether it does or doesn't have a planet. But I would say that this detection at 70 microns is very sound. So those are our first two observations, and we'll be getting a lot more of them in the coming months. So we're releasing our program actually tomorrow. It will be scheduled starting the first week of April, and we ought to have a lot of data by the summertime, our first 20 to 30% of our data. If you want to keep track of Spitzer and what's going on with it, I'll just advertise these couple of meetings at the AAS in June. There should be a big first results from Spitzer there. There's, of course, the TPF Darwin meeting in San Diego in July. And then in November, there'll be a special topics meeting devoted to the first year of results from the Spitzer Space Telescope. Thank you very much.
So, Fred.
Yeah, we do. We've actually we sort of spot included about 15 stars with known extrasolar planets, partly for this kind of confirming our modeling. We're going to look for the distribution of the dust in the disk. We're going to ask if there's a gap there, and we're going to infer the presence of planets by there being a gap that would dynamically carve out a region. We have some that we know where the planet is already, and if we know there's a planet at 3 AU, well, there darn well better be something going on there. So yeah, we do. I'm just looking for, in case someone asks about something I need more pictures for, this is the 50-slide version, just in case.
Okay, this, the presence of this mineralogy, whatever it is that an indication of a debris disk rather than, I mean, are these dusty material, I'm just trying to sort of see your logic here. Are these dust already processed in a parent body and then spread all over the place, or are these the primordial dust?
It's not, well, it's thought that they're processed, but an exact mechanism how that happens is not clear. What's thought is, in the diffuse interstellar medium, you see well less than, well, say, under 3 to 5% of the silicates are in crystalline form. Right, so let's start with that as an assumption. In some of the slightly older post-Herbig AEBE star disks, you see percentages of order 10 to 15% of crystalline silicates. The inference being that somehow that dust was incorporated into the disk, brought into close to the star, melted, allowed to cool very slowly and crystallize, and then thrown back out, this is the tricky part, thrown back out to a distance of, say, 1 to 10 AU, where we now see it at 300 Kelvin. It had to heat up to at least 1400 degrees to be melted in the first place. So that at least tells you that it went somewhere in the disk. Now, some people have argued that that's evidence for large-scale radial mixing in the disk, but it's complicated and it's not clear. The only other observable you can point to is that that's what we see in the comets. You know, they also have this same kind of feature in them. So whatever your favorite mechanism is for creating comets, You could invoke the same argument here in these protoplanetary disks. But, you know, this is just a story. No. Actually, I should have mentioned that. In the evolutionary part of the study, there are several other questions you could ask. Is stellar mass a factor? Is binarity a factor? Is environment a factor? Those are sort of the three big ones that we would have wanted to attack, but our program was cut in half, unfortunately. As we saw, binary stars can have a different evolution. You probably know the story of pre-main sequence observations of disks around binaries, but over the range of separations of binaries between 50 and 100 AU, they definitely seem to clean out the material associated with those temperatures. So submillimeter observations, for example, have shown a nice disparity between binaries between 50 and 100 AU and very close binaries or very wide binaries or single stars. So for close ones, much closer than, say, 20 AU, or binaries separated much greater than 100 or 200 AU, there doesn't seem to be any evolution. But in the binaries between, say, 50 and 100, there is observational evidence that there is clearly a difference in the evolutionary paths. In our sample, we have thrown out binaries when we knew the star was a binary, but not every star has been scrutinized in exactly the same way. There are ongoing programs to follow up with large-scale adaptive optics surveys for close companions and radial velocity monitoring for spectroscopic binaries. This is a legacy science program, I should mention, which means the data become available to the whole community. Instantly, in fact. The archive opens on May 7th, so you all can go in and reduce these horrible things if you want to. The reason I mention it is because what we're hoping is that individual investigators will build on any one of those axes I mentioned, either do a complementary study in stellar mass, separate out the binary stars from the singles in our sample, or go ahead and look at different environments, you know, an environment with a large UV flux versus very quiescent star formation, that sort of thing. Those are things that we couldn't do in our program, but we're hoping that general observers will build on what we've done.
Just one follow-up on what you just said. It's often said that UV photoionization is the primary mechanism for disk depletion. Now, in the context of the Orion region, where you've shown all these problems, there's clear evidence of it. Now, do you think that there is a spread of disk age there as much as between 1 to 10 million years, just like anywhere else? Or is the disk depletion timescale in that region much faster than anywhere else?
I would say the latter rather than the former of what you said, in that right now, I can't really answer your question, right? All I have is that one sample. I have stars in the trapezium cluster. They're all 1 million years old or less. And what I do know is that right now, 80% of them have evidence for near-infrared accretion disks within a tenth of an AU. That's a very interesting case because, of course, the disks are being photoevaporated from the outside in, more or less. And you can imagine asking, okay, suppose everything down to 10 AU, I think that there are, you know, where the stuff could be gravitationally unbound and get evaporated away, is something like 10 to 20 AU. That's another way of saying that is I'm cutting off the reservoir. And then if I allowed the viscous evolution timescale to take over at 10 AU, those disks would go away relatively quickly compared to the ones in Taurus. But I can't test that hypothesis, except maybe in the following way. I could assume that the trapezium, which is, by the way, just on the edge of being a bound stellar entity versus an unbound open association. So I could say, let's assume it's bound and then compare it to the evolutionary scales of the 55 million year old open clusters, IC2392 can't remember the other one, 2602 and 2391, or Alpha Per versus the Pleiades versus the Hyades. And maybe I could build up an evolutionary sequence for just high UV environments versus non-field stars, which apparently just diffuse into the galactic disk on timescales of order 10 million years. And maybe I could get at that question in an evolutionary sense, splitting the samples in that way. But for Orion itself, I can't say.
Other questions? Well, Mike is actually going to be here for part of tomorrow as well.
Right? Yeah, till about 3.
And I'm sure that a lot of people have questions because to bridge over this understanding of observation, some model interpretation of observation, and what we want to do, it's important that everybody can find justification in what you presented here to their favorite theory, I think.
So that's a homework assignment for tonight.
The question is, which piece of quote-unquote evidence you want to spin to your theory? And I can think of many. So let's have some coffee and talk about it.
Great, thank you.